and somewhere on this good boffo stretch of coastline lay the house of this inconsolable man, a man whom many regarded as being insane. But this was only, as he would tell people, because he was. One of the many, many reasons why people thought him insane was because of the peculiarity of his house, which, even in a land where most people's houses were peculiar in one way or another, was quite extreme in its peculiarness. His house was called the Outside of the Asylum. His name was simply John Watson, though he preferred to be called, and some of his friends had now reluctantly agreed to do this, Wonko the Sane. In his house were a number of strange things, including a grey glass bowl with 8 words engraved upon it. We can talk of him much later on. This is just an interlude to watch the sun go down and to say that he was there watching it. He had lost everything he cared for and was now simply waiting for the end of the world, little realizing that it had already been and gone. Chapter 16. After a disgusting Sunday spent emptying rubbish bins behind a pub in Taunton and finding nothing, no raffle ticket, no telephone number, Arthur tried everything he could to find Fenchurch, and the more things he tried, the more weeks passed. He raged and railed against himself, against fate, against the world and its weather. He even, in his sorrow and his fury, went and sat in the motorway service station cafeteria where he'd been just before he met her. "It's the drizzle that makes me particularly morose." "Please shut up about the drizzle," snapped Arthur. "I would shut up if it would shut up drizzling. Look! But I'll tell you what it'll do when it shuts up drizzling, shall I? No. Blatter." "What?" "It will blatter." Arthur stared over the rim of his coffee cup at the grisly outside world. It was a completely pointless place to be, he realized, and he had driven there by superstition rather than logic. However, as if to bait him with the knowledge that such coincidences could in fact happen, fate had chosen to reunite him with the lorry driver he had encountered there last time. The more he tried to ignore him, the more he found himself being dragged back into the gravitic whirlpool of the man's exasperating conversation. "I think," said Arthur vaguely, cursing himself for even bothering to say this, "that it's easing off." "Ha!" Arthur just shrugged. He should go. That's what he should do. He should just go. "It never stops raining," ranted the lorry driver. He thumped the table, spilt his tea, and actually for a moment appeared to be steaming. You can't just walk off without responding to a remark like that. "Of course it stops raining," said Arthur. It was hardly an elegant refutation, but it had to be said. "It rains all the time," raved the man, thumping the table again in time to the words. Arthur shook his head. "Stupid to say it rains all the time," he said. The man's eyebrows shot up, affronted. "Stupid? Why is it stupid? Why is it stupid to say it rains all the time if it rains the whole time?" "Didn't rain yesterday." "Did in Darlington." Arthur paused wearily. "You going to ask me where I was yesterday?" asked the man. "Eh?" "No," said Arthur. "But I expect you can guess." "Do you?" "Yeah, begins with a D, does it? And it was pissing down there, I can tell you." "You don't want to sit there, mate," said a passing stranger in overalls to Arthur cheerily. "That's Thundercloud Corner, that is. Special reserve for old raindrops keep falling in me head here. There's one reserved in every motorway calf between here and sunny Denmark. Steer clear is my advice. It's what we all do. How's it going, Rob? Keeping busy? Got your wet weather tyres on? Ha ha!" He breezed by and went to tell a joke about Britt Eklund to someone at a nearby table. "See, none of them bastards take me seriously," said Rob McKenna. "But," he added darkly, leaning forward and screwing up his eyes, "they all know it's true." Arthur frowned. "Like my wife," hissed the sole owner and driver of McKenna's all-weather haulage. "She says it's nonsense and I make a fuss and complain about nothing. But," he paused dramatically and darted out dangerous looks from his eyes, "she always brings the washing in when I phone to say I'm on my way home." He brandished his coffee spoon. "What do you make of that?" Well, I have a book," he went on. "I have a book, a diary. Kept it for 15 years. Shows every single place I've ever been, every day, and also what the weather was like. And it was uniformly," he snarled, "horrible. All over England, Scotland, Wales I've been, all around the continent, Italy, Germany, back and forth to Denmark, been to Yugoslavia. It's all marked in and charted. Even when I went to visit my brother," he added, "in Seattle." "Well," said Arthur, getting up to leave at last, "perhaps you'd better show it to someone." I will, said Rob McKenna. And he did. Chapter 17. Misery. Dejection. More misery and more dejection. He needed a project, and he gave himself one. He would find where his cave had been. On prehistoric Earth, he had lived in a cave. Not a nice cave, a lousy cave. But there was no but. It had been a totally lousy cave, and he had hated it. But he had lived in it for 5 years, which made it home of some kind. And a person likes to keep track of his homes. Arthur Dent was such a person, and he went to Exeter to buy a computer. That was what he really wanted, of course, a computer. But he felt he ought to have some serious purpose in mind before he simply went and lashed out a lot of readies on what people might otherwise mistake as being just a thing to play with. So that was his serious purpose, to pinpoint the exact location of a cave on prehistoric Earth. He explained this to the man in the shop.